Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is January 9th, 2014. I will be talking a little bit about solar conditions tonight, the cold, the extreme cold weather in the United States. I'll talk about the Venus Inferior Conjunction, a little bit about the Pacific Ocean food chain, and some other major topics, but I'll be continuing on the topic of also explaining why we are having this cold weather, and some continuing in the vein of what I call positive science, science that will help you in your daily lives. That's what we should be doing. A little bit on Yellowstone also, but let me start out with the sun. Actually, the sun had a flare the other day, and it should be reaching us momentarily. With they have claimed this is an X-class flare, and this continues in the vein of over-reporting. That's the only thing I can tell you. If you look at the GOES registers, the satellite information, it barely, for 1 second, crossed into the X region. Primarily a series of minor M-class flares, actually many of them coming out of sunspot AR1944, but certainly not an X-class flare. There was a blip in which we got a number of relativistic protons, and those are indicated in the SOHO cameras as, they call it snow, but they're little white streaks where the protons come in, ionize the camera cells and cause little white streaks, but certainly not the kind of snowstorms that we have seen in the past. So basically, the CME that happened the other day was actually a rather minor one. It was Earth-directed, and we could see some high-latitude auroral activity, although we see that every day. So there again, there's nothing to report here. So anyway, the sun is relatively weak and has been. The real story is the cold weather conditions up in the upper states. Severe cold. Severe to the point where they canceled schools 4 days in advance in Wisconsin and Minnesota, the epicenter of this tremendous cold spell. But basically, the sun is extremely weak. That's the cause of this. I've gotten emails from people, is there a planetary alignment? Could it be caused by, a comet or... No, in this case, it's simply the fact that the sun is extremely weak, and we're just not getting energy from the sun. A number of years ago, NASA had a science project. It was actually administered to it from above to understand the solar output. And so they built some equipment imagining that this would, and kind of the point of it was to point to global warming, to see how the sun was changing on a long-term scale. The equipment was not built for short-term rapid analysis of the solar conditions, light, energy output across the electromagnetic spectrum, etc., and certainly was not built to understand anything about the electrical output of the sun. One of the biggest one of the biggest energy components of the solar output is in terms of electrical energy, the excess current of positive charged protons from the sun that I talk about that causes the solar capacitor that basically drives all of our weather, drives the discharges that all of the planets are going through, all of the planetary weather, the ability of planets like Earth to continue to adapt more material constantly, primarily in the case of Earth, more water, and we see this in storms. I've talked about that many times. But in terms of energy, the sun is just extremely low, and this, I would say at this point, after years of seeing really no sunspots, now understand we do have this AR1944 sunspot is an extremely large sunspot, But in terms of sunspots, it's a really, really very weak. It's a very weak sunspot. It did pop out a little CME the other day, coronal mass ejection. But there again, that was a relatively weak one. The proton flux from that was relatively weak. They're calling it an X-class flare, and it, like I say, it popped into the X-flare region just momentarily for probably a half a minute, and then all of the rest of the mini spikes are down in the M region. So you can't really call that an X-class flare. I'm sorry, but it's like in a hurricane, which they do sometimes. They try and over-exaggerate a hurricane, and if it gusts to 100 miles an hour, they call it a second-degree hurricane or something like that. Or say, but when it's really not even past tropical storm status. In other words, they take a gust of wind that possibly reaches 100 miles an hour, which isn't hard to do because the tornadoes are on the leading edge of the hurricanes, and so they clock that and they say it's a hurricane when NOAA needs extra hurricanes under its belt when they've made bad predictions. They'll take any breeze that crosses 70 miles an hour and call it a hurricane. So anyway, that's what's happening with the sun. But the real story is that the northern climates are suffering tremendously from cold conditions. I've heard people talk about glaciation over Canada and possibility of no summer. Last spring, we had record winter leading into May. And so what we're seeing here, if this trend continues, is extreme cold. And is this climate change due to you driving your SUV around? No. It has nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing. And so the so-called climatologists, what they're doing is they're following the temperature changes and then going with the flow. Now everybody's going to be talking about global cooling and what we can do. There were people who actually proposed experiments to curb global warming by spraying sulfuric acid, by spraying aluminum particles into the atmosphere to block sunlight. There were all kinds of weather modification proposals out there. But why would you do that when the Earth is actually cooling? So the current trend is into not just cooling, but extreme cooling. I wouldn't even call it cooling. It's just extreme cold. So predicting weather is difficult. Predicting climate is even more difficult. And I guarantee you there's nobody out there that has a model, a working model, that makes any sense at all. The only working model is the one that I've been talking about, in which the sun's minute-by-minute output is what we receive. We receive that sun about 8 minutes later. And so, for example, the relativistic protons that came out of that CME the other day, a mini blast of them, I would say, came along near the speed of light. So they came along with the visible observation of the CME, the blast coming out of the sun. But other than that, really, the solar output has not been there. Now, back to the story. NASA was given a contract to understand the sun. And so in traditional NASA form, they built the spacecraft and instrumentation to verify their preconceived notions, which was to verify long-term solar change. The very first thing they learned was that the sun changes on a minute-to-minute basis. But unfortunately, the satellite had already been launched. The information they were gathering was on the general condition of the sun, not individual spots on the surface, because they think that the solar energy comes from the core and it should be distributed evenly over the surface. And it's just exactly the opposite. The energy from the sun comes from the surface. It comes off of the sun in very minute regional areas. And so how could instrumentation that was meant to study the whole sun on a long-term basis to time average the entire sun, how could that possibly study the true conditions of the sun? So all of that time and effort, they spent about 6 months studying the sun, and the only conclusion they came to was that the sun changed so quickly and rapidly they had no way of understanding it or even measuring it with the equipment they had. So they basically stopped reporting data, but I imagine they kept getting their money. So the end result is we don't know anything about the sun. We have not had any real studies. There's over 50 land-based solar observatories on Earth, and there's not a single shred of data out of any of this that corroborates what the sun is really doing at any given time. But the thing we can tell in general, the thing that I can tell, is that the sun is extremely weak. And this is apparently going to continue. I would advise people in the northern climates to brace themselves and to prepare for a long spring. And there again, that's just a warning. Get ready, have food in stock, and of course, always have your own water system. The one thing I should prepare people for, too, is that water filtration only works when water is in liquid form. When water freezes, it can actually break your water filter elements. So if you have wet water filter elements and they freeze, you would have to replace those because they're going to break up, they're going to break down internally, and they're simply not going to work anymore. They may appear like they're filtering water, but they're really not. The water's just passing through little cracks and crevices throughout the filter. So if your water filter element freezes, you don't have to throw out the container, of course, unless it freezes and breaks. So don't let that happen. Don't leave water in your water filter if the conditions are freezing. And, of course, that's a big problem in a house, too. If you have water lines, if you have plumbing, and the house freezes, it can destroy all your plumbing. Not a minor event, since most plumbing is in the walls. So once again, over-advertisement of solar weather conditions by the Rothschild-owned weather networks out there, the weather.com, the spaceweather.com, all of the weather reporting stations, and very much overemphasizing the idea that there's global warming. Remember that the whole purpose of global climate change and the Tier 2 research that involves that is to control water. Very simply put, it's been a tool to control water. And, of course, the scientists jump on the bandwagon. Remember when global warming was going on, everybody was a global warming specialist. As soon as they realized that really the Earth was cooling, then it became climate change. So that no matter what happened, they could ride the financial bandwagon to success. Anyway, okay, enough of that. But the solar conditions right now, extremely weak. The chance of any magnetic activity actually is zero, literally zero. And there is so little activity in the solar wind that the monitors are actually showing it as zero. So I'm not sure where spaceweather.com is coming from, talking about severe solar conditions and flaring. It just is not happening. False reporting once again. Inferior conjunction of Venus coming up January 11th. So in a couple days, what would that be? 2 days from now, so that's Saturday. Inferior conjunction of Venus, and along with that, two items that are scientifically known to happen. One is the increase in sunspots. And so isn't it interesting that we do have a very large sunspot going on right now? And, of course, none of the reporting agencies of standard science are associating that with the fact that we are right now, because of the curvature of the solar wind, it comes out kind of like a curveball, not directly linear. There are two electrical discharge paths for any object. One is the curved solar wind, which tends to dominate when you do not have a full-blown electrical discharge, as with a highly developed comet. So the one of the paths is out the curved solar wind. And the, for example, with Venus inside Earth's orbit. So we've already been seeing that effect, and that is very clearly, in my way of seeing, the cause, the root cause of AR1944 is sunspot activity being large, and instead of having many sunspots, we have one big one, which is interesting. But then there's the other linear electrical discharge, and that's what we should be seeing. A little bit of activity, we could be seeing some heavy wind activity around the 11th, but there again, the sun is so weak and the solar capacitor is so weak that it's hard to imagine that we'll see anything out of the norm. If there is anything on those days, it would be hard to point to the inferior conjunction of Venus as the cause, although in many years we really could see it happening. We actually saw Venus go comet a number of times. You could see it in the SOHO satellite, that the Venus actually developed a tail. And historically, by the way, astronomers throughout the ages on many occasions have seen Venus develop a tail. I did a number of shows on the a topic called The Ashen Light of Venus. It's a dark side brightening of the planet Venus. And that's when Venus develops a tail. The influx of material is so great that it comes in and actually the dark side of Venus actually luminesces. And this has been recorded throughout history. A number of years ago, NASA came along and made the official announcement that the ashen light of Venus never existed. Go home, don't think about it anymore, because it couldn't possibly happen in their static, do-nothing solar system. But if you look at the real data taken by the scientists that studied this throughout their lives, they even had patterns and locations where Venus would do this, would act up like this more. So the ashen light of Venus is real, and as I said, I personally observed it to have tail activity throughout the ages. Other people have observed it to develop a tail activity, and that's reminiscent of its comet stage that is still active throughout the... remember that Venus is a brand new planet. It developed from a large comet. We have historical evidence of this, and once again, standard science denies all of this and pretends that comets are little teeny dirty snowballs. And of course, out of 6 visits to a comet now, they have not detected a single trace of ice or water or snow of any kind on the comet nucleus, let alone anything coming off the comet nucleus to create a tail. Remember that comet Schumacher-Levy 9, as it came in to Jupiter, 21 pieces in that streamer of particles. They were all water comets outside the realm of Jupiter. As soon as they got into the region around Jupiter, they turned into sulfur dioxide comets. They're all red. If you look up on the internet and you look at the pictures of Schumacher-Levy 9, it's shoe just like a shoe you'd wear on your foot. It's spelled Schoemacher. Levy, the second word is L-E-V-Y, named after Gene Schumacher and David Levy, who discovered the comet. But it broke up into 21 pieces, and as they approached Jupiter, they turned into sulfur dioxide comets. They're all red. They're not white comets. So how do they all magically know, as soon as they cross that boundary of Jupiter's sulfur dioxide region, to turn into sulfur dioxide comets without a trace of water coming off or any other volatiles like carbon monoxide, because Jupiter is dominated by sulfur dioxide for very complex reasons. So at any rate, just the data, and then when those 21 pieces hit the upper region of Jupiter, they discharged the Jupiter capacitor, the proton capacitor on Jupiter, and made explosions that were bigger. Even the small pieces put out explosions that were even larger than all of the nuclear bombs on Earth combined. The Russian scientists were watching these And the way they saw them, because the impacts were on the far side of Jupiter at the time, they could not see these explosions directly. They saw the X-rays reflected off the moons of Jupiter, which were on the far side of Jupiter at the time. That's how they detected it. There was so much X-ray activity coming off these explosions that they literally reflected off of the moons of Jupiter, and that was measurable at Earth. Not a little snowball, folks. Not by any stretch of the fairy tale imagination. So at any rate, just a little bit more commentary regarding the inferior conjunction of Venus. So what to expect on the 11th? Possibly we are already entering some flu season, and that is once again an indication that we are touching that tail of Venus. Actually, there has been a lot of flu going around lately, and I can't say that was due to the inferior conjunction of Venus, but also in the medical journals. This is known, and it's been known about since the Chinese back in around the year 1250. They began noticing that during the inferior conjunction of Venus, the swine and bird flu strains were accelerated. They were augmented. And so eventually this was studied by medical doctors, and it actually exists in the medical journals, the association between Venus, the inferior conjunction of Venus, and flu. So I've talked about before the military viruses that have been placed in the public have been coordinated with the inferior conjunction of Venus to hide them amongst the naturally occurring viruses in the tail of Venus. And remember, when they went to Comet Vild, they went through the tail with the space probe, the NASA space probe, Stardust, it was called, to catch the material in the tail of Comet Vild that it detected. When they got the material back, they detected viruses. So there was building viruses in the tail of that comet, in the chemical soup that is being built in the tail of the comet. So Venus being also a comet, having cometary properties, developing viruses in the tail, and I've talked about this many times. There have been times when we've had planetary alignments. In fact, we do have a Jupiter alignment at this time, not a very strong one, but we do, we would see actually new strains of viruses, quite different than the old ones, because the region of Venus's tail was different. It was stretched out because of the electrical alignment with Jupiter, which is happening right now. So that's an interesting factor also. And remember that Comet Ison was supposed to be up and above Earth at this time. It was supposed to be the comet of the century. And, of course, it's not there, which brings me into my next commentary. I said this last week, and I'll repeat it. But I'm repeating it for a reason, because this past week, a number of nutcase government-controlled outlets started reporting red dust on Earth. And, of course, these are false reportings. One of them occurred in Texas, and they're claiming that this is proof that Planet X exists, or is in the solar system, which is, in this case, just nonsense. The more of the sky is falling Chicken Little Planet X reports promoted by the government-sponsored nutcase webpages to basically throw flack onto the topic of Planet X. But basically, in Texas, it rained mud onto the cars, and it was reported, and people who are not familiar with Texas thought that the sky was falling. Well, no, this is common in Texas, and what happens is that if it's dry, you get the winds from the west, it blows up into a dust storm, and then if it rains, that dust comes down in the rain as mud, And many times it's red. If it's from one of the regions of West Texas where the dirt is red, the clay dirt is red, then that powder can be reddish and it comes down on the cars. But if this were caused by Planet X, don't you think it would be in any other place besides Texas? Well, of course, it'd be all over the place, and it's not. It's just in Texas. So, once again, the nutcases are out there, and of course, this is all military-sponsored. The CIA military, Mossad-sponsored baloney science and crazy science that is presented to you, and those are all available and promoted. So that's what the public sees. It's, as I call it, the dog and pony show that's put up there for public consumption. You have the Tier 2 NASA ridiculous science, fairy tale science on one side, and then you have the nutcase internet wannabe clowns out there on the other side, and that's what is promoted to the public. But once again, going back to Comet Ison, when Comet Ison first came out, I went through its orbital path and made the predictions, and one of the predictions I made was that if it was still held together and still with us, which it is not, by the way, that on this time, January 13th to 14th, we would have the linear alignment with Venus, we would have Earth, by the way, we have the new moon, plus the new moon passing 2 days after the new moon, and then Comet Ison up and above us, perfect electrical alignment with the planet Jupiter. But of course, Comet Ison is not here. And what I said is if it were here, we could possibly see Ison hooking into Jupiter and some sulfur dioxide rain in our upper atmosphere to the point where it might be visible. And I said this was an indication of what the ancients talked about in the I called it the red hand of death. That's what the ancients' term was. I didn't say that we were going to all die or it was going to be a death knell for Earth. I said it would be just one of those visible indicators of what the ancients were talking about. And of course, this was all stretched out of proportion by the Naval Observatory and the other nutcases out there that work for the government to provide you fairy tale science about comets. No, what I said was this: if it were visible, it would be an indication of what the ancients saw, but the ancients were bombarded by the sulfur dioxide. It came into the atmosphere and dripped down like fingers and poisoned the water, turned the waters red. And poison sulfur dioxide is a very poisonous material that would have killed off the livestock, and that's what we saw. One of the plagues of Egypt was dealing with the red water, the sulfur dioxide water. And by the way, that's why one reason why I sell the modular water filtration and storage system is that you have access to a storage system that is completely contained, closed, and with screw tops, so that you have clean stored water. Look around your house. How many people have something they could actually store water in for long-term use and protection? Well, not really, not in quantity. You might have a little pan with a cover on it, or you might have a pressure cooker, a couple quart pressure cooker, but how about 20 or 40 gallons of water? No. Nobody has that kind of container just sitting around. So that's why I sell it in a filtration system. Because if emergencies like this happen, even if it's a man-made disaster, like a volcano going off, which I'll be talking about next, I'll be talking about Yellowstone, you need some way to filter and store water. Filtering it is not enough. You need a way to store it. And so, at any rate, back to the issue of Venus. So, by the way, Comet Ison, of course, no longer exists. It disintegrated after it passed the sun, and it probably was pretty much disintegrated as it went around the sun. It did develop a tail on the far side of the sun. But at any rate, it's not with us. But my point is that after I made my prediction about January 11th to 15th in this time frame for a possible red dust coming into the Earth, NASA, in true NASA style, trying to head McCanny off at the pass, had one of its little cronies publish a paper saying that Comet Ison threw out a streamer of red particles, red dust particles, and it was going to round the sun and come and hit Earth. And then it sent out a second stream of particles, and those two streamers of particles were going to, on January 13th to 15th, exactly coincide and cross on Earth's path and shower Earth with red particles. Well, of course, the whole point of that was to minimize and sideline and head me off at the pass. Well, interestingly enough, Comet Ison is no longer with us. So my prediction was based on the existence of Comet Ison at this point, and so that goes away because Comet Ison went away. But their prediction, they had these streamers leave Comet Ison long before it ever got near the sun, so those streamers, boys and girls, should still be on their way, shouldn't they? And so that's why you find, for example, the nutcase crazy lady that talks to aliens, Planet X, trying to promote the government. And by the way, everything on that page is so government promoted, and so it's just like that little books that you read when you're a kid, Topsy Turvy Town, where all of the characters are doing something weird and upside down or backwards, or the shovels are backwards or whatever, and you're supposed to identify them. That's what that page is like, Topsy Turvy Town of science. And so that's to support, that's subtle support, very subtle, but very obvious, of the Tier 2 fairy tale science. And so, by the way, when we do not see any red dust coming into the upper atmosphere in the next couple days, it'll just show that their prediction is completely false and it never existed in the first place. How absurd to imagine that a special streamer, two special streamers, one directed at Earth and one directed around the sun, would meet on Earth on that specific day. Just like a laser beam of particles, and they were going to cross on Earth. Just absolutely fairy tale science. But published in a respectable peer-reviewed journal, mind you. So anyway, I want a quick talk about Yellowstone. Scientists are finally figuring out that Yellowstone could go off and erupt into a megavolcano, as it has done, I think 11 million years ago was the last time there was a major eruption. I've personally been to the sites where they've dug up the dinosaurs that were killed in that blast. They were small dinosaurs, they're just buried in a layer of ash, and this is in eastern Nebraska, quite a ways away from Yellowstone. It wasn't the Yellowstone caldera that was the cause of that one. It was another nearby volcano in Wyoming. But still, to have the Cairo blast go that far and kill those animals, the pulp, the dust, the gray dust that buried them and killed them reached as far as eastern Nebraska. They say that the Yellowstone caldera would reach as far as eastern Minnesota, possibly into Wisconsin, possibly farther. And, of course, the dust would rain down over the entire eastern United States, possibly ruining the entire breadbasket of the United States farming district. And this is not a small issue. But nowhere do these scientists talk about the solution, and I've talked about this before. We have to drain the water. Yellowstone Lake, which is now really polluted. There are no fish in it. It's highly acidic. It's polluted with every sort of sulfur compound imaginable to man. And this is over the last 10 years ago. Yellowstone Lake had fish in it. The buffalo ranged freely around there, but they're all dead now because of the seismic activity and the vapors, the poisonous vapors that are coming out of the breaches in the volcanic magma below. But what has to be done is that water has to be drained out of there, and I've talked about how to do that. You put tubes up and over, there's a rim, there's a low rim on the southeast corner of the lake. Bring it up over there. You don't even need pumps. You can do it by siphoning. And siphon the water out of Lake Yellowstone. It has to be done. Otherwise, if there's a breach and that water drops down into the magma, that's where the supervolcano will come from. If you don't have that water there and there's a breach at Yellowstone, it'll just be a big lava flow. It won't be dangerous. It won't kill everybody on the planet. And so that's a mega project that it's really not that big. Simply put a tube, the same kind of tube you would use for oil pipeline, over the southeastern rim, southeast of the Yellowstone Lake, and then drop it down and into the scab land of Oregon, which is wasteland anyway. There's nothing out there. The water would evaporate away, and we'd be left with a pollution lake there, which would dry up. And basically, you could harvest the chemicals out of that, which would be, there'd probably be a lot of companies that would actually do it and make a financial gain by harvesting the chemicals, the sulfur and other sulfur compounds out of the lake water that would drain down into the scab lands of Oregon. So that's, in fact, the tube would not have to even run that far because the topographical layout of the land would allow the water to run down into the scab lands. Like I say, most of it evaporating on the way. But you've got to get that water out of the Yellowstone Basin, of the Yellowstone Lake. Get all of that water out of there and keep it as dry as possible, because a thimble full of water turns into an explosive, powerful explosive material. Once it superheats on that magma, it turns instantly into super steam. If you understand the conditions of steam, and many steam, either nuclear or gas-powered generators, they superheat steam, and it's called super steam. It's a higher pressure than just 212 degree steam. It's a much higher pressure that develops in steam. It's called super steam, and that's what happens in these volcanoes. What happens, for example, under Mount St. Helens, when the earthquake started, the fissures would allow the water that was trapped in the lakes and in the underground water reservoirs to drop down into the magma, and that's where the explosion. Remember, Mount St. Helens blew the top off that mountain, and the ash ended up in New York City. So imagine what Yellowstone caldera, 50 miles across, would do if that water dropped down into the magma. So an absolutely essential project, but you have little Obama in the White House playing basketball. He doesn't know anything. He's a complete idiot, and everybody else that sits around in Congress are complete idiots. The only thing they know how to do is move money and move the New World Order agendas into place. Whereas something like this that's absolutely fundamentally necessary, and what's more, the Tier 2 geological scientists have no clue what to do. All they can tell you is, oh yeah, we think it's more probable now than we did before. Well, gee, thanks, guys. Collect your paycheck and have a good steak tonight. Just a quick mention, 10% sale is still on. And I thought, you know, it's actually been fairly successful. And I'm going to leave it there at least until next Sunday. It was supposed to end last Sunday. But what I want to do is make sure people are getting their supplies. And so the mainly water filter supplies, of course, everything is on sale. The books, the water filters, the solar sunstar clock, the recalendar sunstar clock, everything, literally everything, the prices are reduced. You will see those sale prices in your shopping cart. They won't be reflected on the sales page. We didn't go through and change all the numbers on the sales page. It'd be just too much work. But the prices, the savings, will be reflected in your shopping cart. So if it says $100 in your shopping cart, it'll be $90. except that, of course, shipping is not reduced because we still have to pay shipping. So we can't give you 10% off shipping, but we can give you 10% off the sale price of items. And so I'm going to set that as this coming Sunday evening. We're going to end the 10% sale. So have at it. And that's also a way of thanking you, my listeners, for being a wonderful audience over the past year. Just a quick topic, Fukushima and the death of the Pacific Ocean. Once again, a completely underreported topic. The Fukushima pollution of the Pacific Ocean, and what it's done is it's killed off the lower portion of the food chain. It's already dead. And this is being reflected in the larger sea life at this time. The tuna off the west coast off of Santa Barbara, they're saying that the tuna is so polluted that they cannot process it. And this is radioactive pollution. And, of course, the way that happens is the food chain, they are on the top of their particular food chain. And unless you're a seal or something, not much really goes after the tuna. They're one of the top end of their particular line on the food chain. And so the small life, from the plankton on up to the small sardines, they are saying are almost gone, almost nil at this point. And so there's nothing left for the bigger fish to eat. And even if there were, they're highly radioactive, because what happens is the plankton filters the water on a constant basis, constantly filtering the water, taking nutrients out of the water. Well, if the radioactive pollution is in the water, then the plankton is also getting a dose of that. That's where it starts in the food chain. It goes up into the little teeny fish and the other small sea life, and then the bigger sea life feeds on that and up through the food chain to the terminal members of the food chain. So the right now the reports are that the smaller sea life in the Pacific Ocean is almost extinct. This is a direct result of Fukushima. It's a direct result of the reactor water draining underwater and into the ocean and then following the ocean currents. And, of course, they're trying to get the rods out of there, but it's just a giant disaster, absolute disaster. Not a very bright tale on the Pacific Ocean, and the only thing you can say is it's somewhat contained between Africa and Western South America. The amount that's going to actually transfer into the Atlantic Ocean, probably it's hard to say. Eventually it might start affecting the Atlantic Ocean. But you have South America blocking it, and all of the Americas, the North American continent all the way to Tierra del Fuego, blocking it from entering the Atlantic on one side, and then you have Africa and Asia and the North Pole blocking it on the other side. And so I don't know if they've measured around as far as the Canary Islands to see if it's reached there in the oceans or not. But by the way, I talked about the Canary Ocean, the Canary Islands, and earthquakes last week. I believe I covered that on my show last week. But at any rate, and if I didn't, let me just mention that. Oh yeah, I did. I talked about the coal fields of Pennsylvania, and the fact that Ignatius Donnelly, when he was Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota, wrote a number of scientific texts, geological scientific texts, and dealing with the multiple layers of coal in Pennsylvania, where he grew up as a kid, and that these had to have been made by some method, primarily tsunamis. And so the tsunamis would come in, wash the material in, but the point was that that material made it as far as Pennsylvania, that far away from the ocean. Anyway, listen to last week's show dealing with that particular topic. I just want to make a few announcements. Every week there are more and more nutcase stories on the internet, so I'm just going to take a second to dispel them. I'm not going to mention anything more about them. There's some clowns jumping up and running around out there saying that there's a black Death Star that's supposed to come to Earth in May of 2014. And remember that every year, May, for some reason, the merry month of May, is the date or the month in which the disinfo crew selects to have a lot of misinformation about celestial disasters. Some years it's, oh, we're going to all be killed by asteroids, or maybe planet. Remember the 2003 crazy lady talks to aliens, Planet X. End of the Earth was supposed to happen in May 15th, 2003 or something like that. Well, this year it's already starting. The Black Death Star is supposed to come and kill everybody. Well, there is no such thing. There's no Black Death Star. And so you can, but this is part of the ongoing desensitization of the public. And a lot of people hear this and they just get so tired of hearing it, they turn off the topic of Planet X. And that's the whole point of it. The other topic I talked about was the Texas mud. And by the way, there is a term. It's actually a term that's common in Texas. It's called Texas mud. It's when it rains mud out of the sky and it gets all over your car and on the roads. And it's a big mess. And it's, like I say, it comes from the dust storms in West Texas that blow up into the air, and then it rains, and all that dust comes down in the rain. It's called Texas mud. It's not it's not Planet X causing this. Okay, so at any rate, let's see. Oh, and by the way, this is a topic I wanted to talk about for a while, and I'm going to insert it here. You have heard a lot. Obama has talked about this. A lot of people have talked about hardening the grid. And so there's a lot of misconceptions about this. And so I wanted to clarify something. First of all, none of us want an EMP or a solar flare to damage the grid. The electrical grid is a very important component of our society. Everything runs on electricity. Without electricity, modern life as you know it would end. And in fact, life would end for most people because they're so dependent on electricity. So, and then there's also the case where the powers that be can use the pulling the power grid to usher in new forms of control. So all of these possibilities, and then blame it on a solar flare or blame it on South Korea or North Korea or whatever. But at any rate, I want to clarify something. The smart grid is a series of electronic controls that allows not only electricity to flow or not flow, but what it does is it controls the electricity usage to your house by the drop flow. And that's the intent of the smart grid. It's like public health care. It has nothing to do with health care or taking care of you. In fact, it's an absolute disaster. More people have lost their health care over the new Affordable Health Care Act than will ever get it back. It's an absolute disaster. Okay, so at any rate, that's one issue. But the whole point of the smart grid is to control the flow of electricity to your house, so that now you're going to have to go out and buy smart toasters. You're going to have to buy a smart microwave. Your old one won't work. Remember when they converted to high-definition TV? You could buy a box to convert your TV, but everybody had to convert to TV, and now everybody has to pay for TV. Isn't that convenient? But along with that came the controls and other measuring devices in your home with the intelligent TVs that go along with it. But the smart grid is nothing more than a mechanism to understand and know everything you're doing in your house with electricity. A hardened grid, a grid that's resistant against solar flares or EMPs, is a completely different animal. It's a completely different animal. The way you control surges is with a little item called a diode. In fact, even with the fastest computers, by the time you detect a surge from an EMP or a solar flare, but by the time you detect it and try and pull the plug on it, the surge has already gone past you because it happens to be moving at the speed of light through the wires. So a smart grid is a misnomer. It's a misconcept by people who don't understand the first thing about engineering. If you have a computer system and a reactionary algorithm to respond to a solar flare or an EMP, that baby is by you and into the next state before your computer can switch and react to it. And so the hardened grid is a non-intelligent grid, exactly like Tesla designed in the first place. You have diodes in place, and those diodes and shunts are the things that act and react to EMPs. There's a thing called an inductor shunt, and what it does is it has a resistance of zero when the current is passing normally, DC current, but as soon as you get a slight change, that shunt resistance goes up to near infinity. And it's in what it would do is you could have another series of components that would literally burn out, like inductant fuses that would guard against EMPs. Once again, fuses are not the cure-all for, or circuit breakers are not the cure-all for EMPs because they move so fast. The other thing about a surge that is not well known is the electricity doesn't flow through the wire, it flows around it. Because the current actually pops out of the wire and flows around the outside of the wire because there's so much electricity. And so it doesn't burn up the wires, it goes around them, and it's going to flow around any electrical component in its path. So once again, an inductance fuse is the way to control that. And of course, that's something that Tesla had to deal with his Tesla towers when he was gathering electrical energy from the ionosphere, is how to control the surges. And you do that with inductance fuses. And what happens, as I said, it's a coil of wire, and as the current is passing through it in DC mode, it simply creates a magnetic field, but and the resistance is near zero. When you have a pulse, the resistance changes instantaneously with the pulse to infinity and blocks the pulse from passing. And so at any rate, that's a hardened grid. It's different than a smart grid. So don't let anybody fool you into thinking that if you put all of this electric circuitry and control and management into the grid, that somehow you're going to protect it. That is a lie. That is a lie. Do you understand what a lie is? It's the opposite of the truth. And that's what Obama is trying to push. Or the not Obama, it's a... remember, he is simply middle management. It's another way of controlling the public with one of the main things you use, electricity. The control of water. My recent book, Water, talks about the control of water through various administrative agencies. And it's the same thing with health care. It's a way of controlling your body and having all the information about your body. Your body is no longer yours. It belongs to the government. And the government is just an implement of control in the unending quest to control everything you do. So health care, water, smart grid, put them all on the same side of the list because they all do the same thing. They control the public. And as I said, don't confuse smart grid with hardened grid. A hardened grid is a non-intelligent component in the grid that blocks the EMP as it is happening. That's a hardened grid. A smart grid, as I said, the EMP is by you and in the next state before that computer system can react to it. Okay, on to the next topic. I'm going to talk a little bit about the weather situation in the north because this is extreme conditions that people are going to have to deal with. Literally, as I said, the sun is extreme low energy. The solar conditions are not changing. So let's go through a little bit of the history of this. Let's go back into the 1990s when we were having regular solar cycles, we were having regular winters. We had some severe storms that came out of the early 1990s. Remember the perfect storm, the three hurricane systems that moved through the United States in late October of 1991. And many people in the northern states remember that major storm system that moved along the Canadian border that created some of the record snowfalls, 31 inches one day, 36 inches the next day in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and basically was a himmicane, overland himmicane in October. That was storm number one of the three storms. Storm number two came through the Appalachian Mountains and dumped a tremendous amount of snow. And remember, these are himmicanes over land, hurricanes over land, or what I call himmicanes. The third storm came up the eastern coast, and they met in the frigid North Atlantic to create the greatest hurricane of all time, called the Perfect Storm. Three hurricane systems joining into one in the North Atlantic. And where exactly is the warm water that sustained this hurricane? As I said, more fairy tale science. Warm water does not create hurricanes. It has nothing to do with it. But my point is that then we move into the mid-90s, where we had regular solar cycles. Then along came Hale Bopp, which pumped up the solar surface energy over a period of 6 years. We had tremendous solar flaring. We had tremendous reaction and a tremendous buildup of the solar capacitor. As Hale Bopp discharged the solar capacitor, we had typhoons with 300-mile-an-hour winds in the Pacific, things that we don't see anywhere close to that today. We had many of the big tornado systems, 70 to 80 tornadoes at a time running through the central United States. Okay, so at any rate, let's move up to the year 2000. We had a double solar peak, once again caused by reaction of Comet Hale-Bopp, and as Hale-Bopp moved out of the solar system, we went down into the solar doldrums. We went for 600 days without a single sunspot, and that's one thing what I was wondering, would we react and come back to have an even stronger solar peak, or would it be very weak? And the end result, the data is in, it's a very weak solar peak. Extremely weak solar peak, the weakest actually going back to the Maunder minimum in the Middle Ages. So brace yourselves. I think this is going to be long term, and probably an extended long spring. Remember the website jmccsci.com. Thank you, and we'll talk to you next week. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.